You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM, all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, and every U.S. military base in the world, simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and hundreds of cable systems nationwide by Free Speech TV Network. Welcome to our program. The Trayvon Martin issue, crime, let's call it what it is, crime, continues to dominate the headlines. And I think rightly so. Anderson Cooper last night interviewed a couple of eyewitnesses to the shooting. These two women, Mary Kutcher and Selma Mora Lamilla, who apparently in whose backyard or thereabouts, you know, in proximity to their house, this crime happened, where this fellow, George Zimmerman, who was a wannabe cop, he was in classes to become a police officer, apparently, or at least that's what he told the police in front of these women from what they've said. And, you know, was a neighborhood watch volunteer with a weapon, you know, with a gun. That, you know, this guy, well, here's, what they're saying basically is that the police didn't want to talk to them. They didn't see the shooting, but as soon as the shots were heard, as soon as they could, you know, as soon as they heard the shots, they looked out and they saw George Zimmerman straddling the dying body of Trayvon Martin. And they basically said the police didn't want to talk to them. You know, they had their story, which is that, you know, the guy who Zimmerman was innocent because of the so-called castle laws, the so-called stand your ground laws, the shoot first laws that Jeb Bush signed into law as governor of Florida proudly. And that we have in, I believe it's 16 other states in the United States. Now, this is what they said to Anderson Cooper last night.
What was your impression of the police's attitude toward this? Did you
they
form
were
an
fighting
impression?
With him.
With Zimmerman?
Oh, yeah.
What makes you say that?
I guess just their nonchalant attitude, because he's in, you know, classes to be a police officer. And, you know, he has a squeaky clean background, which he does not. It has come out what his background is, and let him go.
Yeah. And this guy's still running around loose, you know, thanks to this law that was proudly signed into law by Jeb Bush. Something that seems to be overlooked by everybody covering this story. Another great Republican law brought to you by the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, the Koch brothers, and the National Rifle Association. What is Zimmerman running around with a Kel-Tel 9 handgun and chasing? It's just this police department, the department itself, in my opinion, is guilty of a crime. For police officers to fail to enforce the law or to fail to investigate a crime is itself a crime. There are both standards and laws that govern the behavior of police departments, and they're not following either one. And now apparently it's going to take a grand jury. I guarantee you, if Trayvon Martin had been a 17-year-old white girl instead of a 17-year-old black young man, Mr. Zimmerman would have been in jail faster than you can say, whoops. Guarantee you. This was a kid. His English teacher described him as an A and B student. Zimmerman, on the other hand, had a record of assaulting a police officer back in 2005. He's called the police 46 times since the first of last year. people in his own community. Now, keep in mind, this is a largely white gated community. Trayvon Martin was visiting a family member who lived there, had walked to the 7-Eleven to get some Skittles and a can of iced tea, was walking back home. While black. And Zimmerman mutters under his breath about, you know, racial epithets and calling this guy an obscenity and saying, oh, they always get away. And I mean, it sounds to me like this guy, at the very least, George Zimmerman, if he wasn't mentally ill, he was just like not the kind of person you want to have as a next door neighbor. And especially not the kind of person you want to have running around loose with a gun. Well, you can thank Jeb Bush for that. And not the kind of person that you want running around loose with a gun, knowing that there is a law that says that if he feels at all threatened or intimidated, he can kill somebody. You can thank Jeb Bush and the Koch brothers, Alec, and the National Rifle Association for that. The chief of police in the city of Sanford, Bill Lee, he was going to wrap this case up Monday night. No charges. He said, his words, chief of police, Bill Lee, there's no evidence to dispute the shooter's claim of self-defense. No evidence. How about the fact that the shooter weighed 250 pounds, the kid was 140 pounds? How about the fact that the shooter, you know, other than being twice the size of the kid, was almost twice the age of the kid? How about the fact that the shooter was running around with a Kel-Tel 9mm semi-automatic handgun, and the kid who was laying dead on the ground was armed with a bag of Skittles and a can of iced tea? How about the fact that he had been talking to his girlfriend on the phone and describing this guy who was stalking him? I'm talking about Trayvon Martin. He was describing this guy who was stalking him and chasing him, and his girlfriend was saying, run, 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 and he was saying, no, I'm going to walk fast. I'm not doing anything wrong here. Or that witnesses to the scenes, there was no struggle. This guy wasn't threatened. In the 5 years since the Koch brothers, ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, which custom writes legislation on behalf of corporations and special interest groups, in this case the National Rifle Association, and then hands that off to state legislators to pass, to propose and pass as if it was written by a legislator. In the 5 years since ALEC handed this legislation off to, you know, some Republican lawmaker in Florida and they got it through the legislature and Jeb Bush signed it, homicides, so-called justifiable homicides in the state of Florida have tripled. Tripled! This is incredible. And it raises a question about what kind of community we have in America and how we interact with each other, and what does economics have to do with this? Over at equalitytrust.org.uk I'll track it down during the break. Just Google Equality Trust. They've done some brilliant research. Wilkerson and others have done some brilliant research on how in societies with unequal distributions of wealth, where you have a lot of very rich and a lot of very poor, you have less social trust than you have in countries where you have high taxes on the very rich and a good social safety net for the very poor, which causes there to be a larger middle class and lower disparities between the rich and poor. A smaller spread between the two. People actually have more trust in each other. I want to pontificate, consider some of the issues of trust.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, what is the nature of community? And why is it important? Well, it's a cloudy but pleasant day here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. And I was, last night, Louise and I were walking home, and I was pontificating or contemplating. We were meandering in thought forgot what the word is, about the nature of community. And we've lived in a lot of places. And let me preface this by saying this is a continuation of my riff on Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. And what makes people feel like they're part of a community, and why do neighbors know each other, and why do they not? What kind of communities have, you know, neighborhood watches and hire police and live in gated communities? This is a gated community. And what kind of communities, on the other hand, people get to know each other and you just absolutely know your neighbor. And in the 30 plus years Louise and I have been married, we just finished living for 16 months in an apartment building in Washington, D.C., the first time that we'd lived in an apartment building since we were first living together before we got married back in the day. And we've lived in a whole bunch of rental houses, and we've owned, I think, 3 houses, and not at the same time. And, you know, we've lived in a whole bunch of different places, and we've also lived on the water twice. We lived in a floating home community in Portland, 34 floating homes in this little marina, and it's a co-op. Everybody in the marina owns the marina, self-governant. And, you know, a spectrum of people there from a spectrum of homes, you know, from very inexpensive to quite expensive. So it was really a very mixed-up kind of community. Not mixed up, but I mean, you know, a varied community. And now we're living in a marina here in D.C., very similar thing. Most of the people in the marina are retired government employees and things like that. And maybe not most, a lot of them. And but it runs the spectrum from people in their 20s to older people to, you know, some really fancy boats to some really kind of ratty boats. And there's a fellow that was working for the company that we bought the boat from, that was showing us how to make things work and whatnot. And he was over at the house a couple days ago, or the boat a couple days ago, and he said he had just moved into an apartment building. For the first time in years, he wasn't living on the water. He had just moved into this apartment building across the street just a month or so earlier. And he said, living on the water living in these communities has made me so gregarious that people think I'm gay. And I'm like, what do you mean by that? Because, you know, I know shy gay people. And he said, last night I was in the elevator in my apartment going up to my floor, and some guy gets in and pushes the button for my floor, and I'm going, oh, you live on the 4th, 5th floor too. I do too. My name's Chris. What's your name? And the guy has just looked totally freaked out. Like I was trying to hit on him or something. He's like, and he said, that's just, you know, what you do when you live on the water. You see somebody, you say hi. If you don't know him, you introduce yourself. He said, but in apartment buildings, apparently the protocol is quite different. I said, yeah. You know, we live 16 months in an apartment building here in D.C., and I do not know the name of anybody who lives in that building. And we lived in suburban Atlanta for 13 years. I knew the names of nobody. Now, on the other hand, when we lived in Montpelier, a much smaller town, and a town that was regularly shut down by snowstorms that would literally, I mean, cut power to the town for a week, you know, cut off the town from other towns. We had a flood that actually washed some houses away. We knew everybody. Everybody knew everybody. You greeted people on the street. And I don't think it's because it was a small town, because I've been in small towns where that's not the case. The conclusion I've come to, and maybe I'm wrong on this, and if you've got experience or an opinion on this, that contradicts or agrees with it, I'd love to hear it. Here's my take on this. And one of the reasons why, as a society, we've gotten so estranged from each other that you have this, for example, this shooting of Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman, is that those communities where people know that at some point in time, they're going to have to be dependent upon each other. Those are the ones where people will get to know each other. Because, gee, I might need your help. When we lived in the floating home community in Portland, the house that we live in used to be in a floating home community up the river. They got hit by a flood and disintegrated. And they snagged our house out of the river with a tug, and moved it to the Floyd home community where it is now. I mean, people lost everything. And the one, you know, where we live, where the house that, actually, we still own that house. It's for sale, by the way. But, it, you know, where we live there, you know, we had a terrible flood the year before we moved in. And one year we had a snowstorm where we had, everybody had to run out and shovel the decks because it was starting to sink into the river. Same thing with the Marine community here in Washington, D.C. Tornado comes through, hurricane comes through. Everybody gets out to help everybody. Whereas in an apartment building, there's no sense of, you know, this, a disaster could take us all out. And in the suburbs, there's no sense of a disaster could take us all out. At least there wasn't in Atlanta. That was my experience of living in Atlanta. Whereas a small town in Montpelier, in Vermont, yeah, nature did take us out several times while we lived there. So you get to know each other. So I think that, and this goes back to a comment that Louisa's grandmother made to us back when she was alive in her 90s. She died a few years back, and she lived through the Great Depression. She had this farm in Michigan through the Great Depression, and she said, during the Depression, we got to know everybody. Everybody knew everybody. Everybody depended on everybody. And that, in my opinion, is why it was so easy for Franklin Roosevelt to pass things like Social Security, unemployment benefits, child labor laws, 40-hour work week, right to unionize laws, because everybody understood that we're all in it together. And people don't understand that anymore.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And God forbid, but maybe it's going to take such an economic disaster that we all get it, that everybody's vulnerable, for us to get back to that kind of community.
Rock the boat, don't rock the boat, baby. Rock the boat, don't tip the boat.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Rock the boat. Oh, I just got the pun, Jacob. Okay. By the way, stay tuned for the top of the hour. We're going to talk about what no one else will say about going to war with Iran. The real reason why the Republicans are warmongering right now. I'll tell you about that at the top of the next hour. And, you know, just curious about your thoughts on this situation with regard of Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. You know mine. I am also very curious if you've ever lived in a community where everybody knew everybody, and also lived in a community where nobody knew anybody. And if you think my theory that the shared possibility of catastrophe is what causes people to get to know each other, I think this is also why, for example, apocalyptic religions tend to be very community-oriented. The Mormons, for example, if you're a Mormon, you have to have a year's worth of food in your basement because the world's going to end. And so, of course, you'd reach out to your neighbors and friends, of course, the other Mormons, but you would reach out to them because when the world ends, we're going to need each other. We got this year's worth of food here. And it's probably the same way with the Jehovah's Witnesses and with the other very apocalyptic religions. And I wonder about other cultures and subcultures and all that kind of stuff. So anyhow, your thoughts. Robert in Plainfield, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I wanted to make a point on the Trayvon Martin thing.
Yeah.
I want to know if they ever get around to finally prosecuting him and the guy that murdered him, obviously,
George Zimmerman,
in my opinion. Obviously, it would probably be first-degree murder, I believe. And then would they also slap him with a hate crime, possibly?
I think that if they can demonstrate that he was using racial epithets, and it's fairly clear to me that he was, that, yeah, that would make it a hate crime. That's an aggravating circumstance. So there you go,
Robert. Especially after hearing the tapes and the things that he said and stuff
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, no, I'm right there with you. Thank you very much for the call. Mark in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Thanks for listening to SiriusXM.
Oh, not a problem. I really enjoy your program, by the way.
Thank you.
I just was calling to relate a little situation, and you were talking about people, and I think you're partly correct, but I also think there's a respect element to it, and just a quick story.
Are you talking about communities where people talk to each other versus communities where they don't?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and I do believe it is because people do depend on each other, and you want to have that essence of reliability, so you want to be friends with people.
Right.
But even more than that, like my grandmother passed away quite a few years ago in Missouri, up in the northwest corner of it, and I remember as we were in the procession going to the graveyard, people even on dual lane highways would pull to the side of the road and wait for the procession to go by.
Hmm.
It's just, it was just a sign of respect. And out there, when you see people, they wave at you. Even if you have an out-of-state tag on your car,
yeah,
and there's no way they could know you. They just, there's a certain respect for people.
Well, that's the Midwest. You know, that's, I grew up in Michigan. That's small town Michigan. I mean, and it was Lansing when I was a kid. It's gotten to be a bigger town now. But, yeah, I think that there is that culture. I remember being shocked the first time I went to New York City. I was probably 22, and you know that nobody talked to anybody. Everybody kind of pretended nobody else was there, and the streets were like filled with all these people. But on the other hand, as my very best friend lives in Manhattan and was, you know, born there, has lived his whole life there, and I've gotten to see Manhattan through his eyes, and he knows the people in his building and in his neighborhood. I mean, it's like Manhattan is full of these neighborhoods, you know, and people actually do in some of the neighborhoods, people, particularly the not affluent neighborhoods, people do know each other.
They used to have block parties.
Yeah.
You know, they don't do that near as much as they used to. But and I grew up in a little area, just a suburb of where you're at, Boyd's, Maryland, just a little bit to the west of Germantown.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when we lived there, there was a party line. When you got on the phone, you know, you had to wait for your neighbor to get done. So you were sort of forced into meeting your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very, you know, homogeneous sort of, everybody got along. It was a time that I really miss. Those really absent from this area now.
Yeah. And that's what I was talking about with the Great Depression. I think that those communities are more living on the edge, because if you're out in the Midwest and you're in small town Midwestern United States, you are in a situation where, you know, most of the people are living on just barely enough. And so you're closer to that, you know, survival threshold, you know, to promote my theory here. But
yeah.
but who knows? You've nailed something, Mark. Thank you very much for it. It's a good one. Craig in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Craig, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Again, I enjoy your show while I'm on the road. I was actually born in Sanford, Florida.
The town where this murder happened.
You got it. Yeah, I was born there. Actually, there was a hospital down there on the lakefront. It was called Seminole County Memorial Hospital, which is gone now. But I want to say probably in the early 1980s, I went down to visit my father. Obviously, my parents divorced, and I came to Indy. But I went down to visit, and I wanted to play basketball. And there was a park down there by the front, down there by the lake. And my dad said, well, you no one's going to be there until late, but they're blacks, and nobody goes there. Well, I actually went there because I wanted to play basketball. I remember several nights, 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, I would go down and play basketball. And I was asked by several of the guys that were playing ball, it's like, aren't you scared? And I was, obviously, I didn't know what they meant. I said, no. They go, black and whites don't get along down here. And I thought, okay. And that was in 1983, and I thought things would change.
Yeah.
The only other point I would also want to say is this is not the last time that Sanford made the news. Probably about 4 months ago, there was a young lady who went on like a TV show, maybe called Divorce Court. And you might remember this case where afterwards she was really upset about how the outcome came on the TV show. She disappeared. Well, she was actually from Sanford, Florida as well.
Hmm.
This was just 4 months ago.
Wow.
There's a place off of 1792 called The Barn. It's kind of a country music thing, and that's the last time she was seen. And I can't remember her name, but it's been on the national news. It's been on the, you know, it's been published. She was a young lady, mother of two or three. Her boyfriend is the, you know, the prime suspect alleged at this point. But this is not the first time.
So Sanford has a reputation for fear and loathing, shall we say? Apparently, yeah. Craig, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for the insights. I appreciate it. Charles in Atlanta. Hey, Charles, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hey, I've been reading an article from the Sun Sentinel.
Mm-hmm.
It talks about how the Trayvon Martin case passed 390 to stand your ground.
Yeah.
It passed 390 in 2005.
Right.
And also,
so the Democrats were complicit with the Republicans in passing this thing.
Exactly. You know, the point I'm going to make is that, you know, Jeb Bush should be, you know, he should be demonized and called on this, which he should be. But, you know, people like need to pay attention to who are, you know, the so-called liberal Democrats, you know, like Lieberman and, you know,
this would have been statewide, not federal. But
I'm just using the point I'm trying to make is that voting in general, because
sure.
people who are supposed to have your interest in heart don't have your interest at heart.
Well, these are the kind of bills that are presented as, are you tough on crime or not? Do you want to defend people or not? Everybody remembers Michael Dukakis. Not everybody, but you know, people of a certain age. I probably anybody over 30 remembers Michael Dukakis being taken down by George Herbert Walker Bush in that election
yeah.
over the fact that he had let, and it wasn't even him. It was actually the previous Republican governor had let Willie Horton out on a furlough, and Willie Horton had murdered somebody, a murderer who was let out on a furlough, murdered somebody and was sent back to jail. And I believe that the murder and sent back to jail part happened when Dukakis was governor, but the letting him out was the previous governor, the Republican. But not all of that got lost in the sturm and drang of the Bush campaign. Bush basically accusing Dukakis, and Dukakis totally blew it when they said, you know, if your wife was raped and murdered, would you want the death penalty for the killer? And he wandered off into this long discussion about the morality of the death penalty, when what he should have said was, you're damn right, I'd want it, but I know that it's wrong, and so I wouldn't sign it. You know, he should have said something
yeah.
like that, you know, but he didn't show the emotion and he lost the case. And that's what these politicians are afraid of when you pass, you know, when you confront them with legislation where the general public doesn't realize how dangerous and toxic the legislation is. And if they don't vote for it, the next ad is going to be like the anti-Dukakis ad is going to be, no, this guy doesn't stand for law and order. He does, you know, and it's just going to be a terrible, terrible thing. So, but
well, we need some so-called liberal Democrats like Paul Ryan who are willing to like stand up and say, take the hit. You know,
yeah.
Democrats have been pushed to the right for like 30 years because of their lack of intestinal fortitude.
Right. You had at the federal level, we had one Democrat who stood up against the Patriot Act. You had one Democrat who stood up against World War One. I mean, you had one Democratic senator who voted against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution by
you
resolution.
You had one Democrat right. who voted against, you know, the invasion of Iraq. Only one Democrat.
Yes. Yeah.
One congresswoman.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
you know, that tells you Democrats need to, like, I don't know, people are just intimidated by, you know, the threat of, like, oh, they're going to call us liberal. Don't run away from that. Don't run away.
Yeah.
Embrace that.
I'm with you, Charles. I'm
right.
absolutely with you. Thank you for the call. Tim in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening to iHeartRadio. Tim, we got a minute to the break. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. You were talking about, you know, the people back in the Depression and how they got to know everybody and there was a sense of community, and we don't have that anymore. And I was just thinking about my own life and just from my own knowledge of my own, you know, parents' background and my own background, and I've gone through the school of hard knocks. I'm not complaining. I'm doing okay. But, you know, I hate to say it, but I really think that there's just a lot of people that, you know, the me generation and all the distractions, everybody needs immediate gratification and everything. I think that pain and suffering is the only way lead to repentance and salvation, and I'm talking about it on a personal and a mass level.
Yeah, that was my point, is I fear that it's going to take hitting bottom, you know, the whole alcoholism parallel. It's going to take us economically hitting bottom for us to start, you know, coming together and coming out of this. And to wake up, thank you, from the Ayn Randism.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
To wake up from this bizarre libertarian philosophy that I'm out for myself and nobody else. You know, I got mine, screw them. That's, you know, that's a sick worldview.
I'd like to see the world for once all stand.
Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. Kevin in Seattle listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hi there, Tom. Hey, for 5 years, I have not only lived in an intentional community here in Seattle, but I've been the auctioneer and MC for the Fellowship for Intentional Community and co-housing conference that's happened in different cities, D.C. last June, as a matter of fact, and San Francisco coming up this June. But when I first visited an intentional community, I had no idea anything like this existed in the United States and was just thrilled to find it. And Time Magazine calls us one of the top 5 trends in America for intentional communities. IC.org or cohousing.org is where people can find out more information. But it's
yeah.
pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. It's where people live collaboratively and cooperatively.
And not necessarily under the thumb of some charismatic person or any philosophy.
Typically, you know, they're under the thumb of their very own democracy.
Yeah, exactly. And they even run on a consensus. The one I live in runs on a consensus model, which I never believed possible, but works.
Right.
You know, and for the Occupy movement.
Right, and for people who don't know what consensus is, democracy is majority rule, 51%.
Yeah.
Consensus is 100% unanimous. Everybody
yep.
has to agree. If one person says no, the whole thing crashes. And
yeah.
and consensus is actually how most Native American communities worked. It's how
uh-huh.
most Aboriginal indigenous communities around the world have worked for over 100,000 years. Louise and I were up in the what used to be called the Northwest Territories, the northern part of Canada, back in the late 90s. I was up there doing a all-day training for, on attention deficit disorder for Governor Don or Premier Don Marin, who flew Louise and I up there at Yellowknife on the Great Slave Lake. And they had people from Native American communities all over the North come in. We had about 350 people there talking about how to reinvent schools and make them work for Native American cultures and for people who weren't, you know, who grew up culturally different than city culture down south. And then Don flew us across the lake over to, we were in Fort Resolution, then he flew us over to Yellowknife and took Louise and I into a meeting of the MLA, I think it was called, the Something Legislative Assembly, which was the Northwest Territories equivalent of the House of Representatives or the Senate. And these guys, and we met them all, and there was like maybe 15 or 20 of them. They sat in a circle. Each one had in front of him a nameplate that said his name and his tribe. And all the decision-making for the Northwest Territories was done by consensus. It was the only
wow.
legislative body in the world, at least that this is what Don told us at the time, that, you know, a major legislative body in the world that operated purely on consensus. So it is possible. It does work. And Kevin, thanks for sharing the story
yeah.
with us and for passing things along.
You want?
I'm sorry. I just lost Kevin. My apologies. Louise, yes, they were all men, as I recall. Josh in Asheville, Ohio. Hey, Josh, what's up?
Afternoon, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to real quickly comment that on your theory I happen to agree with you, but I also want to say, and I come at this with a historical background, and even though you won't necessarily read this in the history books, I think it's okay to, you know, conjecture about it, and that is, I believe that the modern socialism that we see across the continent of Europe, and I mean that in a good way, they have many, many programs, it seems like they take care of their people as a whole, you know, much better than we do in
yep.
North America. I have always thought that the root of that and the rise of it really came about as a result of the, you know, the greatest natural disaster, if you will, World War II.
And World War I before.
Yes, and the fact that the entire continent was literally destroyed. I mean, you know, physically destroyed. You know,
yep.
everyone lost their home. Everyone
yep.
Struggled to eat. Everyone lost immediate family members. Some people lost many family members, or in some cases their whole family. And I know we underwent, you know, a great loss of life here in America as a result of those two wars, especially World War II, but we didn't suffer the physical destructions. Our lives still went on. We still had baseball, for goodness. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah,
absolutely.
I totally got it. And that was my experience of living in Germany, was that people knew each other. People talked to each other. Not that they were like super gregarious, but you did get to know, and it's like, yeah, this was a country that was devastated by World War II, and before that by World War I. So, excellent point, Josh. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Will in Chicago. Hey, Will, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you doing today?
Good.
Okay, well, a couple of points I wanted to get across. You know, yesterday you reported the fact that the violence, you know, the mortality rate in this country is the lowest it's been since before Reagan.
Yes.
Yet down in Florida, the mortality rate has tripled, at least in justifiable homicide, which, of course, you know, if your violence is dropping on one end but rising on the other, then really the increase in violence is a lot higher.
Well, we don't know that. I don't know that the murder rate in Florida has gone up. Just the justifiable homicide rate has tripled, that which is a unique type of murder. But and by the way, it didn't peak during the Reagan administration. It peaked in the second year of the Clinton administration, I believe. But, you know, it was rising continuously through the Reagan administration, and then it started to drop during the Clinton administration.
Right. Now, to address the point, you know, you lived in Germany for a number of years. I lived in Germany as well. And my ex-wife used to live in East Germany, and in East Berlin in particular. And one of the stories that she always used to tell me was about the guards that lived on the wall, or, you know, that basically worked on the wall. And they lived in entirely separate communities from the East German people. They were transported back and forth to work on buses with the windows blacked out. They were not allowed to interact with the East German people at all, because they had a shoot on sight command where if they saw anybody in the neutral zone, they were bound to kill them. They were instructed to kill them. And my contention is, I'm seeing the same thing happening today in our police force that you saw back in East Berlin, 30, 40 years ago. The officers no longer live with the people that they have to monitor or watch or patrol. They don't interact with the community. It's a shoot first, ask questions later mentality. And I think part of this whole thing down in Florida, at least what concerns me, is, you reported it, that the officers talked to this Zimmerman guy. Oh, well, he's part of the establishment. He's in school. He's going to be one of us. So let's just accept him at his word and not dig into this.
Yeah.
And
I think there is a sense of, okay, this is one of our guys, and that dead kid, he's one of their guys. And so, and when you create an other, as you so well described, Will, the East German guards, for them to perceive the East German citizens as an other, it's always easier to kill or harm an other. And I think that's one of our economic woes. Up next, what you don't know about the war with Iran.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Okay, here's the question. What's the latest right-wing ploy? Now listen carefully. What's the October surprise? What's the latest right-wing strategy, Republican strategy, to crash the economy before the election? We thought it was Paul Ryan's budget. Except his budget doesn't have a chance. It's not even going to make it out of its own committee. But it would have laid off, hundreds of thousands more government workers, which would have increased the unemployment rate, which would have made the economy worse, and it would have cut benefits to millions and millions of people, which would have made the economy worse because it would have shrunk up demand, and it would have, given huge tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires, so they would have moved even more money into their Swiss banks accounts. But it's not that. I mean, they're trying to do that, right? It's happening in the States, but it's not that. It's war with Iran, in my humble opinion. Now, let me just tell you right up front, this is conspiracy theory 101. I could be wrong, but you tell me if this makes sense to you, because this makes perfect sense to me. And in fact, there are now people out there talking out loud about it, or at least about the secondary effect of it. Yesterday, the head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, she's I don't know if her title is chairperson or president or whatever it is. She's the head of the IMF. She warned that a military strike on Iran, and think about it, this is just common sense, it would disrupt oil supplies around the world. When in 1979, when the Shah was overthrown, Iran stopped producing oil, and oil production crashed, oil prices spiked. It was a crisis for Jimmy Carter just before the election. She said that the price of oil would spike 30%. Lagarde said, clearly it would be a shock to economies if there was a major shortage of exports of oil out of Iran. Quoting the head of the IMF, a sudden and brutal rise in the price of oil would have serious consequences on the global economy. End quote. You get this? Right now, the lifeblood of our economy runs on oil. The food we eat is basically oil. All of our economic production, from how our food is grown to how our products are manufactured, our pharmaceuticals are made, our infrastructure is constructed, how our workers get to and from their jobs, how we power our homes, it nearly all depends on oil. You say our food is oil? What? What are you talking about? Yeah, it's oil that makes the fertilizer. It's oil that transports the seeds. It's oil that powers the tractors. It's oil that takes the finished, that processes the finished foods. It's oil that actually picks them in most cases. It's oil-powered vehicles. It's oil that takes them to market. It's oil that packages them. This is all oil-fueled machinery, right? It's oil that brings it to the local store near you, and it's oil that powers your car driving home from the store. Right now, Brent crude prices are about $123 a barrel for oil. If it went up 30%, like the head of the IMF says would happen if we or Israel were to attack Iran between now and November, if oil prices went up 30%, that would push it over $160 a barrel. Now, back in 2008, about 5 months before the entire global economy went into a full meltdown, the banksters speculating on oil drove the price up to $147 a barrel. And Jeremy Rifkin pointed out on our program that the price of oil is directly related to the stability of the global economy. In fact, he said whenever the price of oil goes over $140, it will tip the economy of the United States into a depression because we're so dependent on oil. And war with Iran would push the price of oil above that critical $150 mark, forcing the global economy to shut down and plunging the United States into a Great Depression. It happened to George Bush, and it wasn't partisan. It wasn't Democrats sitting around saying, hey, let's make this happen. It was banksters, you know, trying to get everything that they could before the whole thing crashed because they built this house of cards on mortgages and on derivatives. They knew it was going to crash. And so it was like, let's get everything we can. So they were pumping oil derivatives as well. And it flipped the election from Democrat to Republican, or from Republican to Democrat, the White House. And if this happens again before the election, then you can kiss President Obama's second term goodbye, which might explain why the political operatives in the Republican Party, you know, I've been trying to figure out, are these people just warmongers like congenitally? No. They're strategists. And the producers and the talent on Fox so-called news, why are they pushing so hard to force President Obama or force Israel to launch military strikes on Iran? Why? Why is it that, you know, in the face of all kinds of opposition, I mean, all the serious observers looking at the Iranian situation, including the two former heads of Israeli intelligence, the former head of Mossad, all 18 U.S. intelligence agencies, from the CIA and the NSA to the Air Force defense, you know, military defense, all 18 U.S. intelligence agencies say Iran is definitely not building a nuke. We say it, our military says it, our intelligence says it, the Israelis say it. Nobody says that Iran is building a nuke, except for Fox News and Mitt Romney. Why? And now the head of the IMF says if you have a military strike against Iran, it would not only be unnecessary, but it would have disastrous economic consequences. Oh, that's why Mitt Romney is writing an op-ed in the Washington Post saying that Iran is trying to build a bomb and we have to stop them. You know, people in Iran and Israel are now taking to Facebook to network with each other and build a campaign for peace before their leaders take them to war. Simple fact is that there's not a single shred of evidence that Iran is building a nuclear weapon, or that Iran, even if it built a bomb, would suddenly turn suicidal and use that weapon. In fact, all the American intelligence agencies say the opposite, that this is not a crisis. So what is the problem that the Republicans are in such a hurry to fix by bombing Iran? The problem is President Obama having high favorable numbers going into an election. That's the problem. The last five times that oil prices spiked, 1976, 1980, 1992, 2000, and 2008, the party that held the White House and was running for re-election lost that year's election. Every time oil prices spiked, Jerry Ford, Jimmy Carter, George Herbert Bush, Al Gore, and John McCain, every single time oil prices spiked, the party in the White House changed. Each one's party had the White House when oil prices spiked as it went into the November election, and each one lost in large part because of it. A war in Iran would make it a sixth time. Normally, a U.S. president gets political benefit from going to war, you know, especially before an election. In fact, George W. Bush told his biographer, Mickey Herskowitz, back in 99, that if he was elected in 2000, in 2001, he'd start a war with Iraq to get enough political capital to privatize Social Security and hand that $2.5 trillion trust fund over to Wall Street. But in this case, a war with Iran would be a catastrophe, and everybody knows it. And if President Obama gives in to the right-wingers who are using our national security as an excuse to get into a war that's going to bring about another Great Depression in this country, then he will have made one of the dumbest, all-time dumbest, most destructive blunders in American history. We can't afford a war with Iran. And when political propagandists like Mitt Romney and Rick DeSantis say we can't, it proves that their allegiance is not to the security of the United States, but instead to their own political ambitions and Mitch McConnell's promise that the Republicans would make Obama one-term president, and their loyalty to the billionaire campaign donors who have been trying to get President Obama out of office for more than 3 years, and the military-industrial complex that funds them. Would Republicans really try to start a war with Iran just to crash the U.S. economy so Obama would lose the election this year? You betcha. And we've got to be vigilant about it, and we've got to call them out. I am predicting this is what they are trying to make the October surprise for this fall, because every other effort that they've made to try and crash this economy has failed. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, am I sounding like Ron Paul? I guess I am. Well, actually, he doesn't have the whole Republican conspiracy theory. I'm just saying, no, we don't want to have a war. It'll be destructive.
The price of gas keeps on rising. Nothing comes for free. I can tell you how this ends.
Well, this is my concern. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. I believe that the Republican Party has been doing for the last 3 years, everything they can to destroy the presidency of President Obama. When you look at the graphs, there's a great story at Talking Points Memo today, over complete with charts and graphs, that shows that during the 8 years of the George W. Bush administration, government employment, the number of employees who were hired by the government, went up by 590,000, over a half a million. And during the first 3 years of the Obama administration, the number of government employees has dropped by over 500,000. Government employees up during Bush, down during Obama. What are the Republicans screaming about? Oh, the government's too big. We got to lay off more people. They've already, you know, between the federal government and the states, they've already laid off over 620,000 people, government workers in the United States. So they tried that. They thought that would crash the economy. But guess what? The economy is producing 200,000 new jobs every month, and so it kind of makes up for that. So how do you crash the economy? Well, you pick a war with Iran. Iran shuts down the Gulf of Hormuz. It stops the export of oil. The price of oil goes to $150 a barrel, $160 a barrel, $200 a barrel, and the economy of the United States goes directly into the tank. I mean, in a matter of weeks. They got another 4 or 5 months to do this. And they're going to try and pull it off. Fred in Chicago. Hey, Fred. Thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
How much are you doing today, Tom?
Say what?
I said, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm great, but I'll get better, Fred. I hope the same is true of you. What's up?
Oh, not much. I just heard your comment about the libertarian philosophy. Of just me, all they care about is me. And I had a problem with that comment, and I just wanted to address that.
Okay.
Well, I think you're completely misunderstanding the libertarian philosophy, and all you have to do is look at this socialist philosophy that caused this housing crisis. You know, we had the law. President Bush signed it, and we had to give everybody a house.
Fred, stop for a minute. You're horribly, horribly misinformed. There never was a law that said anybody had to give anybody a house. Never.
Well, didn't he sign something for Freddie and Fannie Mae?
No.
To make the requirements lower?
No. The law you're talking about, which Fox News and the Republican propagandists have tried to distort, was the Community Reinvestment Act. And what that law said that if you were a bank and you had been practicing redlining, which is where you refuse, say you've got a community that's a fairly poor community, it would be a bad credit risk community, a zip code. Typically, it's done by zip code. And that community, and there's one block in that community of pretty decent homes, and there's a guy living in that community who's got a very, very good income and a great credit score, you still, as a bank, because you've redlined that zip code, you still would not loan money into that. And what that does is it prevents communities from becoming middle-class communities, from lifting themselves out of poverty, because a part of the community has started to get better, but the bank won't even loan to the part that's getting better because they've redlined it. The Community Reinvestment Act said to banks, you may not redline an entire community. You can always say no to an individual because their credit score isn't any good or because they're trying to borrow too much money relative to the value of the house. But you can't do it to an entire community. You can only do it to an individual. Nobody ever said you must write a mortgage. If there was one example of one person in the United States who got a mortgage because the government forced a banker to give it to them, that person would be as famous as Bernie Madoff. The Republicans would have made sure of it that we all knew his name. It'd be just like Willie Horton. Everybody would know his name. What you are reciting, Fred, is a lie.
And
it's a lie that has nothing to do with socialism or libertarianism. Please give me an example of any time when the philosophy of I've got mine, screw you, which is the essence of libertarian philosophy, when that philosophy actually helped a nation.
But that's 100% false. We founded this country on a libertarian principle.
No, we did not.
Yes, we did.
I encourage you, Fred, to read the articles of read the debates that the founders had before the founding of this country when they were writing the Constitution. James Madison compiled them. They're online. You can read them. These guys had lengthy discussions about the common good. Read the history of the George Washington administration. You know who the first president in the history of the United States was to sign a law using federal tax money to pay for poor houses, for poor people, to feed them and clothe them? George Washington.
Well, I would have to say that was probably a wrong thing for him to do.
Well, George Washington didn't think it was the wrong thing to do. John Adams, who followed him, didn't think it was the wrong thing to do. Thomas Jefferson, who followed him, didn't think it was the wrong thing to do. James Madison, who followed him, didn't think it was the wrong thing to do. James Monroe, who followed him, didn't think it was a bad. And every president since then, this country was founded by people who said, we're going to create a community. We're going to create a government that will protect the general welfare of its people. And that's the purpose of it. It's right there in the preamble. Fred, you got to start getting your information from someplace other than Fox News. I'm serious. It's tragic. People thinking like this. David in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just want to comment on your experience of the dissolution of communal identity.
Yeah.
That you're experiencing. That has some real specific origins, going back to post World War II. So as we kind of aligned polarized with the Soviet Union. There was a lot of thinking about how do we drive the economy to recovery, and how do we drive this whole idea of capitalism and democracy.
Yeah.
And one of the things that came out of that was a lot of psychologists thinking on how to...
Hold on, David.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back. David, my apologies. I missed my time cue there, so I'm going to pick you up on the other side. We'll be right back.
And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
This is absolutely hysterical. It's over the Billy Coase and Media Matters. One of these wannabe Andrew Breitbarts, this kid, goes up to this guy who kind of looks like Bono, sort of, and sticks a microphone in his face and says, you don't want your own money to be used for charity, but you want everybody else's tax dollars. And the guy says, I don't know. And he says, you moved you too to the Netherlands to avoid taxes in Ireland. And the guy says, I didn't do that. And he says, yes, you have no control. No, I got no control over the company. And the guy thinks he's got this scoop, right? Bono didn't deny that he has any control over YouTube. He takes it to Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity puts it on the air. Glenn Beck puts it on his website, The Blaze. They're all hysterical about the fact that Bono's denying it. Hannity gets the guy on and he says, how'd you get this scoop? The guy wasn't Bono, right? He says, how'd you get this scoop? This wannabe Jason Matera is his name, the supposedly To quote the Daily Kos diary here by Hunter, the supposedly damn brilliant right-wing journalist, Hannity says, you know, how'd you get this interview? And he says, basic shoe leather journalism. Right. It wasn't Bono. That's why he said, I don't control the company. Anyhow, moment of hysteria, moment of levity. JP in Detroit. Hey, JP, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm a neocon, but I thoroughly enjoy your show. It's more intelligent than the other left-wing shows I listen to.
Thank you, I think.
That's why I like to listen.
what's up?
With respect to Iran, if it's okay for Iran to have a nuclear weapon, would it be okay for them to transmit or transfer that nuclear material or technology or actual weaponry to other nations like North Korea and Pakistan have done?
Yeah, neither is it okay for North Korea and Pakistan to do that. And when they've tried or when we've caught them, we've come down on them with pretty severe sanctions, so severe that North Korea has now made a deal where they're going to say, okay, we're just ending our program altogether. You can bring in inspectors in and come see it. In fact, we're going to end our missile program altogether if you'll just give us some food. So, I agree with the former head of Mossad that Iran having a nuclear weapon does not represent an existential threat to Israel or anybody else, frankly, because there are 42 U.S. military bases within 50 miles of the Iranian border. And Israel has a couple of hundred nuclear weapons. The Iranians are not suicidal.
So I'll ask you again. It's okay for North Korea to engage in this promise not to continue their nuclear program every year, and then they always start it up after they get a bunch of food or money. And it's okay for Pakistan to covertly send out nuclear.
No, actually, what you're saying, JP, is not true. Bill Clinton cut a deal with the North Koreans, and we actually had cameras inside their facilities. They had cameras 24/7 inside all their nuclear facilities that were monitored by the IAEA, by the UN, and by U.S. military intelligence. And that held right up until the week that George W. Bush called them part of the Axis of Evil, which was probably one of the most stupid things any president has ever done in the history of the United States. Because at that point, George W. Bush called them the Axis of Evil, and at that point they said, wait a minute, I thought we had a deal. We would give you complete transparency. We would do no nuclear development whatsoever. They took down those cameras, and within a year, George W. Bush had taken out one of the three Axis of Evil countries, and North Korea had said, you're not going to take us out, and they'd built a nuclear bomb.
So you're essentially going to trust countries that don't trust their own people and kill their own people.
That is not what I'm saying, JP. I am saying, as Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify. And it's very, very simple. And as I said, Clinton did it, and it worked. And George Bush failed to do it, and, you know, we know the result. Virginia in Portland, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Virginia, what's up?
Tom, you're not a conspiracy theorist. I saw a story on Al Jazeera English about a week ago, and I've been looking for it on the corporate American media ever since, and not a peep. And the story had to do with Ahmadinejad being called before the Iranian parliament or whatever it is.
It was before the mullahs, and they dressed him down.
Well,
they took him to task.
And,
they ripped him a new one. They nearly fired him for all his war talk.
Well, and they said if they weren't happy with his answers, he could be impeached.
Yep.
The Supreme Council, as religiously fundamentalist as they are, is not suicidal,
yep,
doesn't like his bellicosity, and does not want to provoke a war with the United States. Does our corporate media report that? No, they just let John McCain keep coming on Meet the Press. They let Lindsey Graham come on Meet the Press. They let they let all the warmongers out there, and they don't push back.
Well, let me take it even a step beyond that. Back during the Bush administration, there was one member of Congress, the U.S. House of Representatives, who spoke Farsi. Farsi is the language Iranians
mm-hmm.
speak.
Right.
He's married to an Iranian woman. He speaks fluent Farsi. And he received, his name is Bob Ney.
Oh,
And he was a Republican.
And he went to jail. So
he did. That's where this story goes.
Yeah, yeah.
He received a communique via the Swiss embassy directly to him, asking him to put into the hands of George W. Bush personally a letter from the Iranians saying, we would like to work a deal out with you. We would like a rapprochement. This was, you know, after we started our war with Afghanistan, I believe. And the Iranians said, let's become friends. Let's be allies. We'd rather be allies than be enemies. Bob Ney took that to the White House. The White House rebuffed him, said, we don't want it. We don't want to see it. We don't want to know about it. Go back to Congress. Bob Ney told a few friends about it. A few weeks later, or a few months later, Bob Ney was indicted for his affiliation with the Jack Abramoff scandal and was the only member of Congress. And the crimes that Ralph Reed committed were vastly worse than what Bob Ney did. And although Bob Ney would be the first to admit that he had broken the law. But he was in jail. He was in prison, safely ensconced in prison, where he couldn't talk about this, you know, for most of the rest of the Bush presidency. And I know this because I know Bob Ney personally. Because
he's now with talk radio.
He's now, yeah, he now works for, he's well, and he when he came out of jail, the person who gave him a job was Ellen Ratner. Mm-hmm. And here was a guy, you know, a former Republican. Ellen's a very progressive person. And here's a former Republican who could not get a job anywhere. Nobody, he was radioactive. Nobody wanted to go near him. But he was the guy, and he told me this story personally, that you know, he had the Iranians wanted to work things out with Bush. Bush wanted to have enemies. It's just like right after 9/11, the government of Afghanistan, the Taliban, said to George W. Bush, said to the Bush administration, this was in the Washington Post. It was a one-day story.
We will give you bin Laden.
Exactly. We will give you bin Laden as long as he has a trial in a third country, in a neutral third country. Send him to Switzerland for a trial. Send him to Qatar for a trial. We will arrest him and hand him over to you if you can show us any evidence. And they were even looking for, they were just looking for a fig leaf, even weak evidence that bin Laden had anything to do with 9/11. If he had anything to do with 9/11, we'll hand him over because the whole world is horrified by 9/11. And George Bush said, no, we don't want him. We want to bomb you.
Well, none of these people realized that George Bush was the decider.
Yes. Well,
they didn't get it.
Yeah. What they don't realize is what Cindy Sheehan, Jacob, pull that clip up, what Cindy Sheehan testified to under oath before Congress, that back in 1999, when George W. Bush was deciding that he was going to run for president, and Karl Rove had decided and was maneuvering against the Bush family, against Poppy and Barb and Babs or what are Barbara's best wishes, that it wasn't going to be Jeb who was going to run for president, because that's who the Bush family wanted, that it was going to be the black sheep of the family, George, that when he was deciding that, the dad, George Herbert Walker Bush, had hired Mickey Herskowitz, who was a writer down in Texas who had known the family for over two decades, written a bunch of puff piece profiles on the Bushes and all this kind of stuff. They hired him to ghostwrite the book, A Charge to Keep, George W. Bush's autobiography, which is in the bookstores right now. They hired him to ghostwrite it. He interviewed George W. Bush for more than 100 hours on tape, and then he went on the record when they fired him because the autobiography wasn't suck up enough, and they got a second ghostwriter, and about, you know, a third of the content of the book is still Mickey Herskowitz's content, but it was, you know, rewritten by another ghostwriter before it finally came out. And Herskowitz went public with this and in print. And this, and what he said is being quoted here by Cindy Sheehan in testimony before John Conyers Commission looking into this in 2003 or 2004. Here it is.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
So there it is, George W. Bush telling, in 99, a year before he was even running for president, telling his biographer, if he becomes president, he's going to invade Iraq to get political capital so that he could do what he wants and have a successful presidency. And what he wanted to do, of course, what he said in 2005, right after the election, 2004, right after the election, was, I'm going to use my political capital to privatize Social Security.
And let me say, Tom, and then I'll get off the line and let someone else get in, because our media will not tell us the truth, because the Republicans are certifiable, The only solution to this is feet in the streets. When Occupy reemerges on May Day, I hope it's multi-millions of people, and I'm going to be one of them.
I'm with you, Virginia. I'm with you. And let's just hope that they, you know, that they can hold it together and make it work. And it's not just Occupy. There's all kinds of other movements as well. Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, democracyforamerica.com, Howard Dean's organization. There's a bunch of really good ones. Virginia, thank you very much for the call. And thanks for listening to KPOJ. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Back with more of your calls. And we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service. Find out what's going on in the rest of the world right after this.
We can bomb the world to pieces.
Yeah.
But we can't bomb it into pieces.
Exposing the con and conservative, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Talk Radio News Service brought to you by the new book, Self-Enlightenment, Nine Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. And speaking of Ellen Ratner,
self-empowerment.
Self-empowerment. Thank you.
Yes.
Oh, did I say enlightenment?
Yes. Well, you're being
enlightened,
too.
That's kind of cool,
too. Okay.
So what's going on here?
Well, a lot's going on. I think today I attended a press conference by Bernie Sanders and several other members of Congress, and or members of the Senate, actually. And this has to do with the oil speculation prices.
Mm.
Now, they are basically saying that these oil speculation prices is what's really driving the price of oil up. And that it's increasing quite a bit, like 40, 50, 56 a gallon, cents a gallon is just one study, and they think it's higher. They could think it could be 70, 80 cents a gallon. And basically, in the Dodd-Frank bill, there was a provision that if somebody was speculating, and unlike the airlines that speculated, for instance, you had one of the airlines speculated, Southwest speculated, and actually were able to drive down the cost of their gas prices
buying futures.
That's right. But and then that's legitimate. But they said 80% of the futures that were being bought were not being bought by users. They were being bought purely by speculators.
By banksters.
And that's right. And they said that Gary Gensler, who is head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, under the Dodd-Frank bill, should be actually putting in the emergency provisions, and he's not.
Right. And he has the power to stop.
That's right. And Bernie Sanders met with him. They said, we met with him last week, and he wanted to have some definitions, and he didn't seem really willing to act. And Bernie actually...
Gensler wanted definitions?
That's right. Huh. He said, according to Bernie Sanders, he said that he wanted definitions of what a swap was. And he said, this was really...
Wait a minute. The head of the CFTC doesn't know what a swap
well,
is?
Well, that's what... I'm just repeating what Senator Sanders said. You can ask him when you have brunch with Bernie.
Yeah.
And he said he wants to know why they're not obeying the law. And he said, this was shocking, and I don't think it was picked up by other press people, the chairman cannot remain in this position if he continues.
Bernie said that. Now, Gensler is an appointee of the president.
That's right.
And does he require Senate confirmation?
I'm sure.
CFTC?
Yeah.
Okay. So
I mean, I will bet him my last dollar on that.
Yeah, and he was not a holdover from the Bush administration.
That I meant to look him up right before I got on the air with you, and I didn't. But
yeah,
okay.
I'd like to track that one down.
Okay, so maybe somebody can call in and let us know. But in any case, I mean, it's really quite shocking. And as Bernie Sanders said, listen, because somebody said, well, how do you know that they're not aware of things in the future, like the fact that oil, you know, is coming slower and we're not issuing permits and things like that? And he said, listen, when Goldman Sachs and Bernie Sanders agree, somebody ought to be paying
right.
attention. And then somebody said, well, how about the president? He said, we hope the president starts paying attention.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I spent the last hour on my conspiracy theory 101 here, my conspiracy theory du jour. Christine Lagarde, front page of today's Financial Times, came out apparently last night, but it's today's news, saying that if the United States or Israel were to bomb Iran, that the price of oil would go up at least 30% worldwide, which would tip the United States and all the other industrialized economies into a depression within a matter of weeks. And I've been trying to figure out why are the Republicans, the neocons, and Fox News beating this drum for war with Iran? And suddenly the light bulb went off.
Because if the economy tanks,
Obama doesn't get reelected.
That's right.
It's really simple. And, you know, so a few thousand or a few million people die in Iran, you know, it's not a big deal. It's get Obama out of the White House. I mean, I don't know. You think I'm crazy?
I'm not 100% sure okay. You're crazy, but I think you might not be crazy.
Okay.
How's that?
That's you know, as a news person, I said, I get it.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. So that was the big one. The president is also visiting solar energy photovoltaic place today. He's doing that in Nevada. Then he's going to New Mexico to talk about his all of above strategy for drilling. Now, it was interesting on the plane today during the gaggle, somebody asked Jay Carney, well, what about the fact that the White House actually put tariffs on solar panels from China yesterday, but then it wasn't enough because the solar industry went up in China yesterday in terms of the market, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so Jay Carney said, well, you can't just have one day looking at the energy policy, et cetera.
Can you reality check something with me?
Yes.
I said on the air earlier that Bob Ney, the congressman, the Republican congressman, spoke Farsi and that he received a communication from Iran during the Bush administration saying, we want to cut a deal with the United States and become your ally rather than your enemy. 100%
true, and you can ask Trita Parsi as well as Bob Ney,
okay.
Who I'll be seeing tomorrow night.
Bob Ney
will be on the air with us tomorrow.
Oh, great. And Bob Ney took this to the Bush White House and was rebuffed, and then a few months later ended up in jail.
100%. And I remember walking up to Karl Rove at the White House Christmas party and saying something to him about it, and Rove just blew me off.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And you know me, I'm going to take advantage of anything. He said, tonight's not a night to talk about politics.
Right.
Yeah, well, guess what?
Yeah.
You're not going to talk to me any other time.
This transcends politics. That's amazing.
Okay.
Thank you for the validation.
So the Senate Republicans did a virtual rodeo row this morning. They wanted to talk about the anniversary, which is Friday, on the signing of the health care bill. Jay Carney said that's an inside the beltway date, and there's no plans to do anything about it. And there's also going to be, of course, the Supreme Court argument next week, radio row, both from Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
Senate is dealing with the Jobs Act, and this has to do with relaxing federal standards, according to this is their job as act, not ours, to small businesses wanting to sell shares of stock to the public. The final vote is tonight. It got the 60 votes necessary. In fact, it got 75 votes necessary. As I call him, the lovable but predictable Peter King.
Oh, yeah.
I actually like
you're talking about the Republican from New York.
The Republican from Long Island. He's kind of cute. He said that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of Hezbollah agents in the United States. So he's on that bandwagon like you cannot
believe. I saw the Chiron on Fox yesterday. And by the way, do you remember
his hearing.
Remember what he said to Nancy Pelosi's daughter when she was doing the documentary? This was just before the 2004 election. He said, we've already won the election.
Right.
We're going to count. We get to count the votes.
Peter King,
very interesting guy. Ellen, we're out of time, but thanks so much. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the law of the land right now is Obamacare, also known as the Affordable Care Act. You can't lose your insurance because you get sick any longer. There's no more lifetime or annual caps on coverage, or soon won't be. It authorizes the funding of community centers in all 50 states, many of which have been built and are operating. In fact, one of my daughters is working at one. 4 million small businesses can now claim tax credits for providing health coverage for their employees. My company is one of them. Nearly 90 million Americans took advantage of Obamacare benefits last year. And Sally Pipes wants to do away with it. She's president and chief executive officer of the Pacific Research Institute, and she has a new book out. It's called The Pipes Plan, The Top 10 Ways to Dismantle and Replace Obamacare. I am holding your book in my hand, Sally. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
And your website, I should say, is pacificresearch.org.
Right.
And so, you know, here we have a plan that certainly I was not lobbying for. I wanted Medicare Part E. I want a single-payer health insurance plan like most fully developed countries have around the world. But it seems a heck of a lot better than being totally at the mercy of the CEO of United Healthcare, who made over $1 billion in his last 10 years on the job.
Well, let me start by saying, you know, I grew up in Canada under a single-payer healthcare system. I experienced it firsthand. Today in Canada, the government will only spend 10.4% of gross domestic product on healthcare. We spend 17.6% here.
Right, we're the only country in the world that spends anything close to that.
Right,
and that's because you've got guys like the head of United Healthcare making $1 billion, literally. And over 100 executives at United Healthcare making over $1 million a year.
Well, let's just get back to the point that I wanted to make.
Well, that's where the money's going.
Well,
they're skimming it off the top.
I just want to talk about, first of all, the fact that Canadians wait on average 19 weeks from seeing a primary care doctor.
If you walk in, Sally, you know that as a Canadian, if you walk into a doctor's office and they find a lump in your breast or they find anything that is serious, you will be you will see a surgeon the next day.
No,
you
absolutely
know that.
Not. My mother died of colon cancer, and she was a senior. And when she, in July of 2005, when she felt she had colon cancer, she was told by her doctor that she was not eligible for a colonoscopy because there were too many people that were a lot younger that were on waiting lists for eight months.
That was an incompetent doctor, Sally.
No, it's not. It's in Vancouver, and you can – I know I have so many stories. I have family members who are doctors. They're all – fed up with the
Sally,
fact that they can't get access.
I guarantee you, and I encourage you to continue to listen, although all 12 lines right now are full. But if some people drop off our lines, whenever I have this conversation on the air, I get just loaded with calls from Canada, from Canadians calling saying, we love our system. You know, you got to wait 6 months if you want to have a hip replacement, but you walk into the doctor's office with a serious medical condition. I had a guy call in last week after somebody was saying something similar to what you just said, and he called in and he said, you know, I went in with the pain in my chest and I was having open heart surgery the next day in Canada.
I'm sorry, that is just not the way it is. I know the system well. I've been a healthcare economist since 1976, so I am very familiar with the system there. I'm familiar with the system here. One of the reasons that
Obamacare is not the Canadian system, by the way.
No, but President Obama, his long-term goal is for a single-payer Canadian-style system. He said it many times in his speeches to the AFL-CIO. I believe that Obama, Nancy Pelosi, and Harry Reid want to crowd out private insurance companies.
I do, too. I think that they are leeches and criminals. You know, there's 34 countries that make up the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development,
yes.
The 34 most developed countries in the world. In 33 of those countries, it is a crime for which you can go to prison to offer primary health insurance on a for-profit basis. We're the only country where it's not a crime. These people who are running these insurance companies, who make their livings saying, no, Sonny, you can't have that operation. No, sorry, John, you can't have a liver transplant. No, we're not going to pay for your bone marrow transplant. These people, in my opinion, should be in prison.
Well, I think that, you know, the point that we need to make is that they Affordable Care Act, which will celebrate its second birthday this coming Friday, March 23rd, is not going to lead to universal coverage. The administration
has already
admitted that, and the cost curve is not going to go down. The CBO came out last week and said originally the health care plan was to cost $940 billion over 10 years. Mm-hmm. They've adjusted that today from 2012 to 2022 over the 10-year period to $1.76 million. We are not going to get rid of the uninsured problem. We will still, by 2019...
I think you meant trillion, didn't you?
Pardon?
You said
1.76 trillion.
Yeah, trillion. Okay.
Yes,
Sally,
the thing is, we will still have 23 million Americans uninsured by 2019. We're adding 18 million people to Medicaid, the program for low-income Americans, and doctors are already not wanting to take Medicaid patients because the reimbursement rates are lower than they are on Medicare.
I'm not here to tell you that it's a perfect system. I'm just asking, here's a simple question, and this is the question that I think is really at the core of this, and that is, do you want government, which you can go to your member of Congress and you can protest out in front of their office all day long, you can write op-eds about them, you can stand outside their office with signs, you can vote them out of office, you can work against their campaign or for their campaign. Do you want government defining the kind of health care we have, or do you want it to be somebody like Stephen J. Hemsley, who makes $500-600 million saying, no, you can't have health care to people as CEO of United Healthcare, and if you try to stand outside his office with a sign, he will have you arrested. Which do you want? Do you want a corporation telling you what you can
do you want
we the people telling you what you can have?
Well, we the people, if we empower doctors and patients, we will get the kind of the affordable, accessible, quality health care for all.
That's not how it was working 5 years ago.
Government, 50% of our health care today in America is already in the hands of government through Medicare,
and
Medicaid, CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Plan, and the VA system.
Yep, and it's working on less than 3% overhead.
One in three new Medicare patients is already having a hard time finding a doctor because the reimbursement rates to doctors are 20%.
No, Sally, I moved to Washington, D.C., and we literally called every doctor we could find just to get a physical. I couldn't find it. It took me 4 months to find a doctor in the city. You can't get a doctor in the city. In most cities in America, it is so hard to get a doctor.
Well,
there's a doctor shortage.
I guess I tend to disagree with you because people I talk to find it so much easier. And so many Canadians come to the United States and pay out of pocket for physicals and for surgeries. I'm sorry, but it's just the way it is. And I disagree with you.
You know, I lived within 100 miles of the Canadian border for probably half my life in Michigan and in Vermont. And I used to see when I lived in Vermont, I saw the Vermonters in Montpelier. I saw the people lining up, the mostly elderly people lining up to get on a bus to go up to Montreal to buy the prescription drugs. I never, ever, as God is my witness, half my life within 100 miles of the Canadian border, never, ever saw a Canadian in a doctor's office or any, you know, caravan of Canadians coming to the United States, literally caravans of Americans going to Canada.
Unfortunately, if you go to Florida, Phoenix, Palm Springs, and Seattle, Washington, my uncle had to come to Seattle, Washington when he was diagnosed in Canada with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. They hadn't even heard of the drug in Canada, the head of the cancer agency in B.C. of Rituxan. He had to come to the clinic in Seattle to get this.
Sally, I'll give you that we've got some, you know, if you're rich, we've got some really good medical facilities here. It's why Saudi sheikhs fly into the United States for cancer treatment at the Mayo Clinic. We got really good stuff here.
Well, the thing is.
But it's only for the rich.
I'm not rich, and I have access to care the kind of.
Well, how did your uncle pay for it?
He paid for it out of his own pocket.
Well, he must have been pretty damn rich if you're talking about cancer therapy.
No, he was just a chap that we didn't even have a college degree. So, but he had set aside money for his retirement, and so he had money.
So he wiped out his retirement.
Yeah, but
so you're saying people should have to wipe out their retirement to get health care?
No, I'm not. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that we need options, and the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is not going to bring about affordable, accessible, quality care for all Americans. And these government-run systems in other countries, look at the National Health Service in Britain. They actually allow private health care to run parallel. 10% of Brits have private health care. But there's a huge
debate going on
in England.
It's not primary. It is secondary.
No, it's primary care, and it's going bankrupt, and they can't afford it. So there are longer and longer waits in the UK for people who have to deal with the National Health Service.
Because the Conservative government came in and said, okay, you can have some privatized part to us.
It started by the Labour government. It was introduced in 1946 by the Labour government, and it's got increasingly expensive, and it's not helping.
Sally, thank you for correcting me.
You
can read Sally's work at pacificresearch.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah. So in a few minutes, we'll get another perspective on Obamacare with Ron Pollack, Executive Director of Families USA. Well, as predicted, after Sally Pipes came in, people are calling to tell stories about Canadian health care and American health care. And Dorothy in Santa Barbara, hang on for just a minute. After the bottom of the hour, I'll pick up your call. But first, Ron Pollack is with us. He is the Executive Director of Families USA. FamiliesUSA.org is the website. One of the best groups in America that is working to expand health care for everybody in this country. Ron, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for inviting me again.
Thank you for joining us. I was just debating Sally Pipes of the Pacific Research Institute about her new book, saying that about how to dismantle Obamacare. And I'm saying, you know, hey, it's not single payer health care, which is what I would like, Medicare Part E, E for everybody, but it's a heck of a lot better than what we had. Give us a summary of what Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act or whatever you want to call it. I kind of like Obama getting credit for it, frankly. I don't think that's a slur. Give us a summary of what this has done, will do, and why are these conservatives so hell-bent for leather on taking it apart?
Well, first let's talk about, as you asked, what is it doing right now? It's doing a variety of things that are very helpful. For young adults, they can stay on their parents' policy until their 26th birthday. There are more than 2.5 million young adults who have already taken advantage of this.
Wow.
For children who have pre-existing conditions like asthma or diabetes, they no longer can be turned down for health coverage due to the pre-existing condition. And starting in 2014, this protection will extend to all of us.
So prior to this law going into effect, if you had a child with diabetes or asthma or any pre-existing condition, your health insurance company could just any old time just say, okay, that's it, you're out of here. We don't want to pay for this. It's going to be too expensive.
Well, they wouldn't sell insurance to you, and that's now a thing of the past.
Okay.
And this will extend to all people, irrespective of age, in 2014. You no longer can be terminated from health care coverage when you get sick or you have an accident, which a lot of insurance companies have been doing. Senior citizens are getting significant benefits. They now can get preventive care services like screenings and annual checkups without paying anything out of pocket, no deductibles, no co-payments. Those seniors who have really high prescription drug costs, who fall in this big gap in coverage called the donut hole, they're now getting rebates of 50% of their costs in that gap of coverage, and ultimately the Affordable Care Act eliminates that gap altogether. Small businesses are getting tax credit subsidies that are enabling them to provide health care coverage for their workers. So there are a lot of things that already have been done, but there's a lot more that's going to take place starting 2014. Perhaps the most significant thing is there are going to be new marketplaces where people can buy private insurance, and anybody who's middle class, who's got income up to 400% of the federal poverty level, for a family of four, that's $90,000 in annual income. They'll get tax credit subsidies that will make health coverage affordable. The poor will get coverage through an expanded Medicaid program.
So why do these right-wingers hate this, Ron Paul?
Because President Obama achieved it. This is, you know what's interesting?
It's just partisan, you mean?
Oh, it's shocking, isn't it?
Well, actually, I figured that there was probably some, you know, it's going to cut into the profits of the health insurance company, you know, that somebody who was making a buck was upset about it.
No, you know, this is really purely partisan politics. You know, the most controversial provision is this individual responsibility provision that requires anybody who can afford health care coverage to purchase it. And if they don't, they pay a tax penalty for that. Well, you know, that's a Republican idea. The Heritage Foundation pushed that. American Enterprise Institute pushed it. Governor Romney pushed it. It's part of
Richard
Romney.
Nixon came up with it.
This is a very popular Republican idea. But now that it's included in legislation that the president supported, now all of a sudden it's become a partisan.
Now both Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan have said over and over and over again, I got the clips, but I don't have time to play them for you right now, that Obamacare cuts $500 billion out of Medicare. My understanding was it cut $500 billion out of Medicare Advantage, which is the part where Medicare hands money off to the big insurance companies and they make a buck off it.
Well, that's a significant component of it. Of the $500 billion, mind you, none of these are cutbacks to the people on the program. Mm-hmm. So what you're talking about is that the private insurance companies that have been selling this so-called Medicare Advantage program, they have been getting a windfall payment of approximately $135 billion. That is being eliminated. What's also eliminated is
that per year?
No, that's over
a 10-year
period.
Okay. $13.5 billion a year still is not chicken change.
No, that's right.
Chicken feed.
That's right. The pharmaceutical companies have agreed to provide rebates, $80 billion in rebates to seniors. So that's going to be helpful. Hospitals were overpaid in a variety of ways, which they agreed to have that cut back. That's about another $130 billion. So what I'm saying is the $500 billion are savings, but they're not savings that harm seniors. Quite the contrary. They make the Medicare program more cost efficient. And, you know, and I've got to say, it takes chutzpah, you know that word,
yeah.
It takes chutzpah for Republicans to say that Obama is cutting the Medicare program. What the House Republicans offered yesterday in terms of their budget, totally transforms the Medicare program.
It turns into a voucher program.
It's a voucher program.
And by
program.
The way, Michelle Bachmann doesn't know that word. Somebody ought to call her up and tell her.
Well, and it privatizes the program. But what it does that seniors are going to be really concerned about is with each passing year, the amount that the government pays as part of your premium will be smaller and smaller portion of what you have to pay, and seniors will have to pay more and more. And with each year, seniors will have to pay thousands of dollars more out of pocket in order to get Medicare.
Yeah, and it's a very, very good step in the right direction. Ron Pollack, the Executive Director of Families USA, the website, if you want all the details, and I commend it to you, familiesusa.org. Ron, thanks for dropping by today and setting the record straight.
Good to talk to you, Tom.
Do appreciate it. And I will, after the break, I'll play some of these clips of Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan basically lying to all of us. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Plus the good, bad, and the ugly. And Dorothy in Santa Barbara wants to tell her story about Canadian and American healthcare. That would be the good, the bad, and the very, very limnophiliously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for your brain. The good. Elaine Johnson. Johnson, a second grade teacher in Sacramento, California, is truly devoted to her job of teaching and caring for young children. But earlier this week, she took her passion for helping kids to a heroic new level. After seeing a car erupt into flames in the school parking lot, Johnson rushed to the burning vehicle where she helped to rescue a young boy and girl who were trapped. While most teachers may never rescue their students from burning cars, all across this nation, teachers consistently go above and beyond the call of duty when it comes to helping our children. It's time we reward them for their passion and do more to fund those molding the future of America. The bad. The Minnesota State House. The Minnesota House of Representatives passed a voter ID measure yesterday that would require voters to show government-issued identification at the polls when they vote. Voter ID laws are popping up all over the nation as conservatives try to disenfranchise millions of American citizens. Those affected most by the laws, such as the elderly, poor, and minority voters, tend to vote for more liberal candidates. So basically, voter ID laws allow conservatives to play pick and choose with the American electorate. I guess preventing millions of Americans from being able to vote is one way to rig an election. And the very, very ugly Fox So-Called News. Fox So-Called News has created an audience filled with racist hatred. After an article about the Trayvon Martin death was posted on the Fox So-Called News website, a flurry of comments began to pop up, and most were marked by racism and intolerance. One comment read, "This could have had a tragic outcome. Zimmerman's gun could have jammed. Whew." While another comment read, "I'm just glad Zimmerman didn't miss and hit an innocent bystander." And let me stress, those were two of the milder comments that were posted. Bad enough to spew misinformation 24 hours a day, but to turn people into racists and bigots that openly spread offensive and hateful comments while keeping a smile? Now that is very, very ugly. And Dorothy in Santa Barbara, watching us on Free Speech TV, thanks for being so patient, Dorothy.
You're welcome.
You have a story for us?
Yes, I do. My 28-year-old son was living and working in the Twin City areas of Minnesota, and he was an IT professional working on contract, looking for a full-time job, as so many of our young people are. And he got a bad case of pneumonia, was rushed to emergency, had a number of tests. They kept him there a few days, released him, and he recovered from the pneumonia. He did not really feel well after that. He then got a job offer in British Columbia. He went to BC about a year later, and within 3 months you have to get onto their health care system. Mm-hmm. As soon as he was on it, he went into the hospital or doctors, and he found out that he was in kidney failure.
Oh my.
They sent for his Minnesota hospital records. He had been in kidney failure at the time he was discharged. He didn't have any insurance at that point. Within a year, I was able to give my kidney to him. They flew me up there a couple of times. He was just, you know, taken care of. And
right.
Today he's so grateful
I'm
and
sure.
feeling wonderful. He's joined the BC Rangers. he's doing search and rescue in addition to his job, and he's got a new lease on life.
That is wonderful. And how much did it cost him to get all that health care in Canada that was denied him here in the United States?
It didn't cost him anything. They even they paid for me to go up and all of my medical expenses to give him my kidney.
Wow. Dorothy,
so he's a healthy young man today because of that health care system.
Baruch Hashem. God bless him. Dorothy, thank you for the call, and thank you for watching Free Speech TV. Thank you so much and for sharing that with us. That these personal stories, they mean so much. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's up?
Well, my story really pales compared to your form, you know, the last caller, but I just wanted to say several quick points. I've worked 30 years as a respiratory therapist with acute care and also in long-term and subacute care, and I live on a border state here in Minnesota. I've yet to take care of one person who said that they were disgruntled with the Canadian healthcare system and that they came down here to get the, you know, more superior capitalized healthcare system down here. And also,
so 30 years in the U.S. healthcare system within a hundred miles or thereabouts of the Canadian border, and you've never seen a Canadian?
I mean, I've never talked to one Canadian patient, you know, or family member. And people, we're pretty intimate with our families, and we get to know them often. And I would think that people would express that oh, they came from Winnipeg and they flew down to Minneapolis because, you know, they're, right, you know, absolutely dissatisfied with the terrible waits and whatever it is that, you know, people.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was saying to Sally. You know, I've spent half my life living within 100 miles of the Canadian border, or more or less half my life. I don't work in healthcare, but I've never encountered anybody who was in town because they were looking for healthcare. And here you've been actually in the business for 30 years in similar circumstances and never encountered anybody. So,
and I just wanted to make one more quick point. I do know of somebody who is a priest here, and his mother lived in Victoria, British Columbia. And they also have access to long-term care. Long-term care is also part of the Canadian healthcare system. And she spent like $15 a month or whatever. She afforded her own health care. She didn't have to sell her house. She didn't have to liquidate all her assets, which is what happens here. And also in Minnesota, United Healthcare is headquartered here, but they cannot give any policies to any Minnesotans because we have nonprofit HMOs. They don't allow for-profit. United Healthcare has been investigated many times by the state attorney general's office for all kinds of shenanigans.
Yeah.
And what do they really what have they really contributed to the general well-being?
Well, they made Bill McGuire into a billionaire. They made Stephen Hemsley into a billionaire. They made a bunch of people into multimillionaires.
Well, one more little story. Medtronic, which developed right here in northeast Minneapolis, not too far away from here, they were the first to develop the heart pacemaker.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they really have significantly impacted the economy here and also have positively, brought good health to millions of people throughout the world. And, you know, that just shows you, you know, how this issue, you know, how these people are, they're parasites. I mean, these. Mm-hmm.
That was my point. People say, oh, you know, Obama wants to put the health insurance companies out of business. And I say, well, I don't think he does, but I want to. You know, I think that they're parasites. I agree with you totally. John, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. Gail in Toronto, Canada. Hey, Gail, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you? I listen to you all the time on Sirius in my car.
Well, thank you.
My mother is a senior, 87 years old, and she moved here from Alberta back to Ontario about 9 years ago, I guess. She figured it was time to be near her family.
Mm-hmm.
Since she's been back here, she had the first year she had emergency detached retina surgery. The following year she had to have glaucoma surgery on her other eye. The following year she fell and broke her hip. And then 4 years after that, she had to get the hardware removed that was put in when she broke her hip.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're going through She's got some bladder cancer, so she's had cystoscopy, bladder biopsies, and, you know, your caller who wrote the book, Sally, I just don't know where she's getting her facts and figures from, because we just don't wait like that when the care is needed. And I've got friends
even
who
for
are
the elderly.
Going through...
Even for the elderly?
No, not at all. And that's one thing that's impressing me about this urologist that's treating my mother, because I'm saying to myself, after she had the surgery to have the growths removed from her bladder, within 2 weeks we had the follow-up, and we're going back in May to check again. And I'm thinking, wow, like he's treating her just as if he was treating the same, giving her the same care as if it was a 45-year-old woman.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't believe it. It's really amazing. And I mean, I've lived here all my life. Now, we may wait, of course, when we go to an emergency room, if something happens and we go to the emergency room. I mean, you do hear the stories where you wait 4 or 5 hours. And
well,
I'm
here
Toronto,
you can wait
so
24 hours in an emergency room.
Well, I've had cases where we've had to go in, especially with my mother, you know, where 5, 6 hours, whatever.
Sure.
But I guess that's to be expected.
Yeah. That's not an indictment of the system.
I'm in a populated area. Now, I'm not saying that people up north and whatever that are far away from the hospitals and everything, they very may well have to wait a long time to get in. You do wait a long time if you want to see that specialist for the first time. For instance, if you have to go and see an ophthalmologist, you may have a 6-month wait to get into a specialist. But once you get in, then if something's happening, things start moving.
Yeah.
I've got two friends who are dealing with prostate cancer and another one with the prostate cancer and the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. They're getting all the treatment that they need down at the cancer hospitals. And we are so lucky. My husband just came back from spending the month of February in Florida. And all the time, the seniors down there are saying, you know, but what about your health care? Of course we pay for it. We pay for it through our taxes.
Well, those seniors are watching Fox News. And Sally Pipes, who was on this program at the beginning of the hour with her new book, The Pipes Plan, she and her mother, her Canadian mother who died of colon cancer in Canada, she is all over Fox News. So it's really important that somebody speaks back to her. And to that information, that disinformation,
okay, we
are doing it. Thank you, Gail. Thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to us up there in Toronto, Canada. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-987-THOM, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our free live chat room, build your own blog, participate in our message
board.
You're
listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Get our free iPhone or iPad app or sign up for our daily newsletter, which includes the Daily Stack, Sue's Daily Stack, which is every link to every story I talk about throughout the day.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
You tell them, Leonard, helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. Aisha in Washington, D.C. Hey, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you today? I love your show.
Thank you.
I call you the Pitbull, Tom.
Oh, really?
You know why?
No.
Yes, because you're one of the few that really go after these people and make them justify what their beliefs are. You're like a pit bull. You know, you really get in there and tackle all these issues.
Well, I kind of think of myself more as a border collie. It's like I do it in a friendly fashion, I hope. But in any case, Aisha, you had a story you wanted to share with us.
Yeah, I just wanted to share. My nephew married a girl from England, and they were living here, young couple, not making much money. She became pregnant. What they had to do when they saw the cost of them having the baby here, they decided to go to England to have the baby because it would be a lot cheaper.
Wow.
Yeah,
and the care is excellent.
The care was very good. And I was talking to them. They were happy. They didn't have the same cost that they were going to have here.
Right. Okay. Aisha, thank you very much for sharing that story with us. And thanks for calling. Thanks
You're
for
welcome.
Listening. And thanks for your kind comments. Pitbull, maybe. Barbara in Austin, Texas. Hey, Barbara, what's up?
Hi, we from the Dorfman. So I had called because I was just curious. As I told the screener, my husband is an emergency room physician here in the United States, and you know, I was telling your caller, he's actually my husband. Actually, would like,
he likes the idea of social medicine because he thinks everybody should get help. But I know for myself, and, you know, I think about, like, how many people in the United States pay taxes. I don't know much about the tax situation in Canada. I'm not, never been there.
Yeah.
Compared to how many people pay taxes in Canada. I mean, I know that more than half of our country don't pay taxes.
No, not true.
So I'm just like,
The Bush recession, it was 36% of Americans don't pay federal income taxes because their wages are at or below the poverty level, which is how bad things have gotten since the Reagan presidency. Back before Reagan took office, it was in the 20%. Now it's 47% because of the recession.
And I made less than most of, I made not very much money, and I still paid taxes.
Well, you were paying FICA taxes, which is different.
He was appalled because he was like, why are you having to pay taxes? You hardly make any money. And I said, well, because that's the way it goes.
Well, and if you're filing jointly, then your income.
I wasn't. We weren't married.
Oh, okay.
We weren't married.
Well, then,
we were dating.
All right.
So my question is, again, the money has to come from somewhere.
Sure.
And I just never think it's okay for anybody to think that they can walk into any place and get something for free. I just don't like that idea.
So you don't think school kids should go to school for free?
I pay school taxes.
Okay.
So they're not, my kids aren't going to school for free.
Right. So and you don't think the fire department should come for free if your house catches on fire?
I pay taxes. I pay.
Right. Okay, then we're in agreement, Barbara. Let's redefine the word free. Frankly, to the best of my knowledge, in this entire hour, I've not used that word. I'm not suggesting that healthcare ever could be free, nor would I suggest that fire service or. But I think that. But shouldn't healthcare be? You know, if we're going to say that if your house catches on fire, Barbara, that we as a society collectively are going to do everything we can to put that fire out. Shouldn't we also say that if your body catches on fire metaphorically, and whether you can afford health insurance or not, we as a society are going to do everything to put that fire out, to put out that cancer or deal with that disease? Isn't your body more important than your house?
As long as people are helping themselves, too. As long as people are helping themselves, too. Because, look, anybody in my family has a history of cancer. When my mother found out she had cancer, she
So, Barbara, what you're saying is if somebody doesn't have a good job, or if somebody is mentally challenged and can't work, or is physically disabled and can't pay the taxes, then the fire department shouldn't put their house out and they shouldn't get any health insurance.
The fire department is paid for by the taxpayers.
Right.
We can't.
But not everybody pays taxes. People who rent don't pay property taxes.
We can't differentiate who pays taxes.
No, Barbara. Only fewer people pay
taxes.
Fewer people pay property taxes than pay federal taxes.
But the apartment complex pays taxes. The person that lives there. I lived in an apartment in my life, and I didn't pay taxes. At school taxes at that time? No, I did not. But I know my apartment complex paid taxes. I know they did because they have to. So basically what I'm saying is that, look, I've been on both ends of the spectrum. I didn't grow up wealthy. My parents both worked. I worked my way through college. I worked after
You've got
college.
Yours and the hell with anybody
taxes.
Else, right?
No. As a matter
okay.
of fact, no.
Well,
I'm
let me just ask you a question. Since your husband's a physician, if you're walking down the street or sitting at a bus stop or sitting in a restaurant and the person next to you has tuberculosis, which is untreated because they can't afford the health insurance, and they start coughing, are you concerned about getting that TB?
It doesn't happen in this state. You're making up ridiculous stories.
Actually, you know, the two hottest hot spots for tuberculosis in the North American continent are New York and Los Angeles.
Extremes of everything. There is a happy medium for every situation.
Barbara?
You look for the extreme for everything, and it saddens me because people listen to you, and then they walk about their life.
Barbara, pause for a second. Check the CDC, the Center for Disease Control Statistics. The hot spots for tuberculosis in the United States right now are New York and Los Angeles. We have active TB going on in many of our major cities, and we're not dealing with it. We're not dealing with it because we don't have a national health care system, and by and large, the people who have it can't afford to get health care, and that's putting you at risk. Isn't there something wrong with that? Barbara has gone. Okay, she hung up. How much time do we have, Jacob? 2 seconds. Okay, all right. Not enough time for another call. They're stacked up, though. People wanting to tell their stories about, you know, loving Canadian healthcare and the problems that they've had here. And actually, I think there was one person. Well, Barbara, I guess, was the person who wanted to disagree. Anyway, coming up tomorrow, What do NASA, intelligent design, and the right wing, right to work for less laws have in common? Find out when I challenge Dr. John G. West of the Discovery Institute. Plus, want to have a big fat steak for dinner? You might not want to after tomorrow's geeky science. Plus your calls in the news of the day. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up and participate. When you get active tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.